Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian fantasy novelist Karen Miller, or K.E. Mills, as she's known for her Rogue Agent series. Welcome to the podcast, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Now, congratulations on the release of the first book in the Tarnished Crown series, The Falcon Throne.
Thank you very much.
I'll dig a little deeper into the new novel in a minute, but first I wanted to say I did a count of the number of novels you've produced since 2006, and to my reckoning it works out to just over 2 novels a year or somewhere around there.
Something like that. Every so often I have to keep stopping and counting back. There's been a certain output, shall we say.
So I wanted to say, in relation to that workload, what's that like, and do you think that maintaining that volume of work is necessary for having a living wage or career from writing?
It's very, very hard, which is one reason why I have slowed down. There's 2 reasons I've slowed down. Number one is because I simply could not sustain that level of output, not creatively and not physically. I'm actually paying a bit of a price for it now with various spinal issues, which a great many writers can identify with. And secondly, the series that I'm working on now, the Tarnished Crown series, is so complicated and so big in terms of scope and characters and world building that, you know, if I tried to rush it, I would be shortchanging everybody, not least, you know, myself, my publisher, and the people who enjoy reading my books. So I did have to slow down. But, you know, it was, so I think starting off, if you can work to a level of quality and quickly, you should, because the world moves so swiftly and people get overtaken and distracted so easily now because entertainment options are seemingly endless, that if you don't establish some kind of a small beachhead for yourself, if you release one book and then it's 3-4 years till you release your next book, it's too easy to get lost in the noise of everything that's out there. There's so much fabulous entertainment, books, you know, cinema, television, all the in the realm of speculative fiction. There's so much fabulous stuff out there that you need to kind of establish a bit of a space for yourself, and then when you've earned a certain level of readership trust, as you know, my fingers are crossed that I have managed to do, you can afford to slow down a little bit on the understanding that you're slowing down because you're working towards something bigger and better. That's the plan anyway, but yeah, it's hard on the brain, and it's hard on the body to produce that much work. I think in 1 year I wrote 4 novels.
That was
hard. Even though some of the work was less taxing because it was media tie-in work and a lot of the work had already been done for me, even so, the sheer physical act of writing, writing is at one and the same time sedentary and really physically taxing. It's a very bizarre thing. You're sedentary because you have to, you know, be still to write the book unless you're on a walking desk, and that's another conversation. But at the same time, everything that you're imagining, and it's weird, it took me a long time to wake up and understand this. It wasn't until I read Neil Simon's first autobiography, Neil Simon, the American playwright, and I read his first autobiography, and he was talking about the fact that he'd been writing this really emotional scene of a play, and when he stopped, he was exhausted physically and hurt all over. And I'm going, hang on, that's how I feel a lot of the time. And that whatever you're playing in your brain, whatever you're imagining, whatever you're capturing with your imagination and translating through to the page, whether it's, you know, any kind of heightened emotion, you're recreating that in your body, and your body doesn't know it's not real. So if the adrenaline's pumping and the muscles are tense, they're tense for real, and you're wearing your body out just with your imagination, which seems entirely insane. And it took me a while to really wrap my brain around it, but it is in fact true. So even though you're sitting still and the only thing that's going at a mile a minute are your fingers, you are stressing your body. And if the more, you know, heightened action and emotion that you write, and my stuff's fairly high volume, you're stressing yourself enormously day after day after day, and that takes a toll.
Yeah, I was going to say, after reading The Falcon Throne, you should be getting paid danger money.
Well, you know, there's also a certain amount of, you know, emotional creative catharsis when you're really, you know, hitting the high notes. It is enormously entertaining, I'll have to confess it. But it's also, you know, enormously satisfying. But bloody hell, it's exhausting too.
All right. Well, you mentioned in there a couple of your earlier media properties that you wrote, and that was Star Wars and Stargate.
Yes.
Could you outline quickly how those, you know, the opportunity to write for those properties arose, and presuming that writing is fairly similar no matter what the genre, in what in particular does an author need to bring to writing for media properties, or perhaps what do they need to leave behind?
Okay, well, the first question first. With the Stargate, what happened was that prior to being a published author with the first two of the Mage books, I wrote fanfic. I'm obsessed with stories. I don't get through a day without feeding my brain and my soul some kind of story. It's a book, it's an episode of a TV series, a film, something. Not a single day of my life goes by where it's not being fed some kind of story. And for a very, very long time, even though I knew I wanted to be a writer and I'd known since primary school that I wanted to tell stories, I lacked the confidence and the skill and the whatever to create my own worlds. So I believed other people's worlds more than I believed my own. So I'd engage in other people's stories, and they'd make me think of stories because I fell in love with their characters and fell in love with their worlds. I guess in a sense I was a frustrated scriptwriter. So I would write fan fiction. And a series of fan fiction I did for the Stargate show, because I love Stargate and I still, you know, love Stargate, was some, every so often they'd have an episode and, you know, because of the constraints of television, it's 40 to 42 minutes and they can't tie up all the little plot lines. And every so often there'd be left a dangling question that would bug me. And so I started writing little coda vignettes from the point of view of the base doctor, Dr. Fraser. And I did a whole series of those and they were really fun for me, and the fans who got hold of them, they really enjoyed them. And it was for the first time in my life writing in first person, which was a bit of a writing exercise for me because it's not, I don't usually choose to write in first person. And once upon a time there had been some official tie-in novels for the series, and for one reason and another that all fell by the wayside. And then a husband and wife team in the UK, Tom and Sally, they realised there was untapped potential, because they were fans and they were in touch with fans and they knew how popular the series was. So they purchased the license to distribute, to publish and distribute the more Stargate and Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe novels in conjunction with MGM, the parent production company. And Sally contacted me because she'd read my fanfic and said, listen, we'd love to have you on board. Now, at the time I turned it down for various different reasons, and I won't go into them because they're a bit political. Mm-hmm. And then my circumstances changed, and I went back and said, you know what, I'd really love to do this after all. Can we do it? And they said, absolutely, give us an idea for a novel. And again, in keeping with my instinct to look at a story and go, you know what, there's something else happened after when the credits rolled, that story hadn't actually finished. And that's how I came to writing both of the Stargate novels that I wrote, because I wanted to finish off the story or pick up the implications and the threads. And I did that, and they did extremely well, and the fans really liked them. So that was the Stargate story. And when it came to Star Wars, oh, that was all shameless hussying on my part. I was a Star Wars fan. I saw, and I'm going to age myself on this, I suppose there's no way getting around it. I saw the very, 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 very first Star Wars when I was 16 in high school in George Street. And my life changed in that moment as the Death Star came overhead. I went, okay, this is the world now. So I fell in Star Wars. And for the record, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Lucas, but Han shot first. And that's the end of that discussion. So I fell in love with Star Wars then. And I did some Star Wars fan fiction as well, you know, because I just love that world and I love those characters. And then the years rolled on, and I sold my first two novels, the first two Mage books. And the first thing I did was contact the people at Del Rey Publishing, who had the license to source and produce, in conjunction with Lucasfilm Limited, the official Star Wars novels, that the whole series that got kicked off by Timothy Zahn's great series. And I said, listen, I'm a newly published author. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. If ever you're in the market for looking for new people, I hope you consider me. And I got an email back saying, well, what do you like about Star Wars? Which characters do you like? And I replied, and that was all very nice. Didn't hear a thing. I thought, oh, well, you know, I gave it a shot.
Hey.
Subsequently, I'd become friends with an amazing British author by the name of Karen Travis. She did City of Pearl, and she did her own stuff. And then she'd been writing a hugely, massively successful Star Wars series with the clones. And she just did amazing things with that. And then they were talking about the Clone Wars cartoon, and they wanted to do some novels connected to that series. And they went to Karen T, and Karen T, bless her cotton socks, said, yeah, I can't do all five, and the only other person I'll prepare to work with is Karen Miller.
Oh, that's lovely.
It was, you know, that's the only reason, is because Karen stood up for me and said, I'll work with Karen. Because we have a similar sensibility, and we'd become good friends, and we knew we could bounce stuff off one another, and there wasn't going to be a problem, because sometimes working collaboratively can get sticky. And then so I was initially, Karen would do three of the five and I would do the other two. And then her career, you know, going gangbusters like nobody's business, things shifted to her, and she said, look, I need to drop one, let Karen take three. And that's how I got the three Star Wars novels. And, you know, I just the other day got asked, would I like to do some more? And it killed me to say no, but right now my focus is on the Tarnished Crown, and I can't take on anything else. So it was very sad that I had to say thank you so much for remembering me, but not this time. Maybe in the future, but not right now. And that's how I got to do the two tie-ins. The most important thing, just getting into your second question, the whole thing about tie-in work, and this is only my opinion, and there are other people who obviously aren't going to think the same way about it, but I speak as a fan first. My feeling is that if you are not a fan of the property or the franchise, I really hate that word, but, you know, the franchise or the whatever that the books are being based on, you have no business writing them, because they're not like regular books. They are an extension of a world that someone else has created and someone else has poured love into, and that, you know, conceivably and certainly when it comes to Star Wars, hundreds of thousands of fans around the world have given time and energy and money into that franchise because they love it so much. So if you are honored enough to be asked to take part, if you don't love it the way the other fans love it, then you have no business getting involved, because they will buy the work because it's Star Wars. And if you don't respect it, if you don't love it, if you don't respect them, even though, you know, everyone knows fans can be nuts. I'm a fan, so I can say that because, hello, I'm nuts. if you don't have that passion for that product, you have no business writing in it, because sometimes people do, and you read the work and they don't know the material and they haven't bothered to research the material, and they clearly, it's a job and that's all it is. And that to me is insulting to everybody involved. So just don't. You must. So what you need to leave behind when you're writing media tie-in work, you must leave your ego behind, because it's not your story. You're telling a story, yes, but it's not your story. In the same way that a person who's on the script writing staff for an established TV series, that is not their series, that is not their story. They are subject to the rules and the vision of the person who created the show and is running the show. So you don't get to walk in and then just rewrite the history and undo all the work that's come before you. And as a tie-in writer, and I think script writers and tie-in writers have a great deal in common, It's our job to honour what's come before, to honour the characters as they have been created, and to hopefully, if you're really lucky, deepen the characterization, deepen the story, deepen the fabric and the world that you're writing in. But it's not yours. You respect what's there and you respect the fans, because without the fans, you wouldn't have a gig.
Okay. No, I can appreciate that being a fellow fan as well. I do agree with you. You can tell straight away if somebody, I think it happens in some Doctor Who episodes in particular where you. Well, I won't go there.
I understand that sometimes people take on work because they need work, but it never ends well. Let's put it that way. It never ends well. If the fans even get a whiff of exploitation or indifference, I think indifference is the thing that gets most people up in arms. Any whiff of indifference, and it's not going to end well.
Well
done.
All right, we'll move on to your Rogue Agent series. Now, that series has kept me in the family good books for about 3 consecutive Christmases. It's a fusion of steampunk and magic, more Edwardian than Victorian. I see it as a light-hearted action espionage series, and it was a departure in some respects from what you'd written up to this point. And I just wanted to ask, what did you want to achieve with that series?
Well, interestingly enough, I would agree with your characterization. And to me, the influence, the cultural influence, is late Victorian, early Edwardian, in terms of, you know, sociology and technology to an extent. It's also a case of, in the same way that I don't just eat Chinese food and I don't just read, spy thrillers or whatever. I read lots of different flavours of books and I eat lots of different kinds of meals. So locking myself into only one kind of storytelling seems to me a little bit difficult. I mean, claustrophobic is like being put into a straitjacket. I have a sense of humour, but the mainstream, the epic historical fantasy, that's more serious drama. It doesn't really lend itself to a great deal of humour. Whereas the Rogue Agent books give me a chance to have a bit of fun, even though there's serious stuff underpinning them. And they, you know, I can't get away from all the dark all the time because that's just my dark and twisted soul coming out. But nevertheless, there is some wit and some humour and some light-hearted stuff. Because that's the other thing. Life isn't always dark. You know, I have a very good friend who is an emergency medicine specialist, and, you know, hang around with a bunch of emergency medicine physicians if you want to hear gallows humour and dark humour coming out. You know, it's a lot of fun, but whoa. But what you're looking at is it's just me exploring a different facet of my psyche that gets poured onto the page. I wanted to have the idea of an ongoing series of standalone adventures, because that's something a little bit different. And I wanted to have a bit of fun, because I like spy stuff and I like undercovery stuff. So it seemed to me that it was a different way to explore the craft and the genre.
Okay, yeah. No, I was on that point about sort of having standalone books. I think I was given book 4 couple of years ago to review.
Yes.
I did find it was, although I do often read books in series out of order, I did find it worked quite well as an independent sort of story. So
that's good. Because, you know, inevitably, because of the way my brain works and it's ended up reasonably serialized insofar as the adventures are standalone, but the characters' lives are following a certain trajectory. But, you know, I'm pleased that it worked, even though you read it out of order.
That's all right. Okay, we're shifting into the epic fantasy stage of this interview. Invariably, in the genre of epic fantasy, particularly after the success of the Game of Thrones TV series, any fantasy writer is going to get compared to George Martin and perhaps even Abercrombie, particularly if you're writing something that's quite gritty and realist or a little bit dark, or if it's got a bit of political manoeuvring in it. And what I notice is that they seem to be the go-to guys. I mean, it used to be Tolkien, but now it's Martin. They're the go-to guys when you talk about adult or realistic fantasy. And I wondered if, is this a help or a hindrance to you as a female writer of epic fantasy or of dark epic fantasy?
Yeah, it's interesting that over the last little while, the whole subgenre of epic fantasy or epic historical fantasy seems to have become turned into this largely, you know, male bastion. I think I'm one of the few women writing in that level of you know, politics, war, darkness, grit, all that kind of stuff. And I think it's tricky because there are whole assumptions and world-building baggage and modern today's cultural baggage that comes along with that kind of storytelling, where people will do a double take and go, "Oh, but you know, you're a woman, so can you really do this?" You know, it's almost like, "Well, I'm waiting for the sparkly vampires. I'm waiting for the violins to start up and the hearts and the roses to come on." And really, no, not with me. But
as I found out, yeah.
but my feeling is that you know. But having said that, you know, a lot of guys, I get a lot of mail from guys saying how much they have enjoyed my work, and that means a lot to me, because I think if you're telling a story, nobody goes to the male writers and says, "Oh, you're writing female characters. Are you sure you should be doing that?" You know, no one questions their ability to be able to write the romance or the female characters. So why I should be questioned on writing the other way? It's more, I think, a reflection on the culture and attitudes and all that kind of stuff than it is about reality. The bottom line is that, you know, don't make assumptions because of the gender of the person on the front of the book. It's, you know, and the whole comparison thing, look, it's people, when you're coming up with new books, sometimes people want, well, what's it like? You know, what's it like? Where does it fit so that I can get a sense of if it's my kind of thing or not? And absolutely, given Martin's influence on the field at the moment, it is inevitable that people are going to say, "Oh, well, it's kind of," and it is kind of like that. If you're talking, if it's epic historical fantasy and Martin writes epic historical fantasy, well, yes, they belong in the same basket. But what gets me a little bit cranky, I have to confess, is people saying, "Oh, well, there's Martin, so why are you doing it?"
Mm.
Well, you know, are you asking Brandon Sanderson that? Are you asking Brent Weeks that? Are you asking, you know, the other guys? And are you asking Joe Abercrombie that? No, I don't think you are. So why are you asking me? The bottom line is, number one, readers can always read more books than any one writer can put out at any one time. So if you love that style of storytelling, you know, it's great to know that there's more than one person who you can pick up and read and enjoy. You know, nobody says to all the romance writers in the world, "Oh, well, there's Nora Roberts, so hang up your typewriter." If you love a particular style of story or storytelling, it's great to have more dishes on the menu than just the one. Especially if one series is a slow producing series, if it's taking a bit of time for that story to reach its completion, then what do you do in the meantime? It's fun to be able to go off and read other people, because no one, you know, you can all write in the same kind of genre, but Joe's books aren't George's books. Joe Abercrombie's books are fabulous, but they're his books and they're his sensibility and his psyche. They're not George Martin's books and they're not my books. And there's room for more than one player on the field, I think I'm saying. So to try and say, you know, "Oh, well, it's silly. It's not fair." By all means, judge the quality of the books, but don't say, oh, well, why are you doing that? Well, I love it, that's why.
Well, and that comes through. I certainly, in terms, if we're going to sort of compare to those other two writers, I've read both of them. I think you're right there. There's a similarity, but there's also a great joy in knowing that your series is probably going to be over in three books. And there's a compactness I found to the Tarnished Crown.
It's a five-book series, and I planned it as a five-book series. From the get-go, when I'm structuring a story, I guess this is my theatrical background, I think in terms of acts. So this is a five-act play.
Excellent. Five books, but when I was reading it, I found that you balanced really well between the epic, like the epic arc of what was, I presume, is going to happen. You'll probably turn that around on us, on the reader, but what I presume was going to happen, the speed seemed and the pacing seemed to be right. I found it incredibly balanced, whereas as much as I really enjoy Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire, that seems to me to be too broad in some ways. But this I found sort of hit the middle road and worked well on all axes.
Well, thank you very much. I think one of the problems in writing epic historical fantasy, and, you know, I've discovered it for myself, and it's something I'm just having to focus on all the time, is when you start introducing a broad cast of characters and you discover these, and you have a vague idea, but as you write the story more, you get to know them better, and you just want to tell everybody's story because they're all these really amazing people, and there's always more to their story than you can put on the page, and you just keep wanting to tell everybody's story and limiting yourself, staying focused, saying, no, look, I've chosen this list of characters to be the drivers, and this list of characters, they're the main point of view characters, and I'm following their stories more than other people's. Sometimes it's really hard to keep it constrained because you love them all. The good guys and the bad guys and the people in between, they've all become these fascinating, multifaceted people, and you just want to, you know, unpack their lives, all of them, and of course it's not doable. You know, every series would be like 48 volumes. So it's very hard to keep that level of self-control. I'm not kidding. I keep saying to myself every day, keep it controlled, keep it controlled, keep it controlled, because the temptation and then when people respond so positively to what you're doing, it kind of feels as though you're being given permission to broaden the scope, and then you broaden it again, and then you broaden it again, and the next thing you know, it's really broad, and then, you know, what was already a difficult job becomes even more difficult. It's just a case of reining yourself in. And okay, I've got one book under my belt. I'm working on book two now. I'm a bit scared about the prospect of expanding even further down the track, knowing what I've got planned for coming up. And that's why this book is so ridiculously large. I never planned to write a book this big. But when the first draft came in, and I knew I'd undercooked it, I knew the back end of the original draft was like the Reader's Digest version of my own story. And when I went back to the editors and said, you know what, I have to unpack this a bit more. It's going to go over the 200,000 mark. And they went, no, don't worry about it. We like the shape. We like where it ends. Just go with it. Well, then they got 260,000 words back. Because that's how much story was in there. And that was with me being restrained.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the curse of the and when we say epic, we're not kidding. And that's the curse of this large storytelling. You just fall in love with everybody, and you want everybody to have their time in the spotlight.
Well, I'm thinking you could perhaps view it as leaving room for fanfic writers to come in and write.
That too, you know, absolutely. But of course, the action now shifts elsewhere after the events of book one of Falcon Throne. The action shifts elsewhere, and some characters carry on, and some characters' stories have ended, as I'm sure, you know, as you understand what I'm saying.
Not happy about that.
Sorry. You know, I think you know, Hamlet was in fact an early influence.
Yeah. No, I can accept that. Yes, not everyone can live happily ever after, put it that way.
No, and that's, you know, and it's tough. I mean, you know, it's tough because there are characters in that first book that I really, really loved, and made me so sad that their stories ended, but that's what happened.
Okay. Well, before we potentially spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, we'll go on to another question. Now, Australian speculative fiction seems to me, at least, to have a very solid group of women writers. And we're a feminist podcast. We've got a charter to present and promote Australian women writers. But it seems to me from small press right up to commercial blockbusters like your book, we seem to be punching above our weight, if I can use that term. I wondered if that was the same impression you had, and I wondered, you've just recently come back from overseas, whether that continues in the UK or perhaps in the US, or if it's entirely different.
Well, you're absolutely right. We do have this phenomenal foundation of really wonderful women writers in this country. Part of that in speculative fiction, and part of that is due to the work by Stephanie Smith, who really, in the HarperCollins Voyager imprint, who really took that imprint and turned it into a phenomenal stable of writers, many of whom, yes, you know, are women, and many of whom who have gone on to have really great careers. And, you know, like Trudy Canavan, who is probably, she has to be one of the single most successful writers Australia has ever produced of any genre.
Mm.
Full stop. Trudy is a phenomenal success, and does not get anywhere near the recognition for that. And same as Kate Forsyth and Fiona McIntosh. These are people who really have done phenomenally well, and Jennifer Fallon just so many people, and Glenda Lark, people who've gone on to establish and Kylie Chan, people who've established great careers, and it's all because of Stephanie Smith, who, you know, has gone a little bit quiet of late. But she left Voyager and now she's doing other stuff. But most of us would not have the careers we have if it hadn't been for Stephanie's ability to recognize something in someone's work that would respond, would, you know, get a chord from the reading public. And I think maybe that's because she's a woman looking to support women, but I like to think it's because she was able to recognise stories that would resonate. And Voyager's also produced, you know, writers like Duncan Lay, and he's done really well. So I think, but it's so weird. It's really, really weird. For all that we've got a bit of a blokey culture in Australia, on some levels, we are, on many other levels, one of the most gender egalitarian countries around the world. We frequently throw up, for example, women high-powered political people, whereas other countries struggle with that. America struggles with that. The levels of misogyny in America against women are quite horrifying. For a country that prides itself on, you know, being at the forefront of justice and democracy and blah, 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 their cultural misogyny is a little bit freaking and depressing. And there is certainly a level of silencing of women's voices going on in the entertainment media there. Women struggle to direct films. They struggle to be directing television, although that is improving. They struggle to be given their own shows to run. So it's largely still a big boys' club. And I think American women writers struggle in the spec fic field to be given the same level of respect, and recognition and readership. someone like Kate Elliott, who has to be one of the single best writers in speculative fiction, and writes, you know, has written a fabulous epic historical fantasy series, The Crown of Stars. She pushes against, you know, being dismissed because it's a, she's a woman writer, and so only the men's voices count. The UK, when you think of UK writers, there aren't that many women being celebrated in the UK in the way that male writers have. And Leckie's success with her debut SF novel, Ancillary Justice, that's really encouraging. That, you know, she scooped the pool of all the major writing awards. So it's there, but I think we just got lucky. We just really got, Australia was ripe for more its own brand of speculative fiction, and the right person hit the right publishing house at the right time to nurture a whole bunch of really great writers and of people who've gone on to success beyond Australia, which is pretty amazing. But it's all thanks to Stephanie.
No, and then that wouldn't be the first time I've heard Stephanie's name come up in conversation in regards to that. Yeah, she probably someone needs to write a biopic or something for it.
No, she'd hate it. She'd hate it. She is one of the most humble, self-effacing, quiet achievers. She's a phenomenal person. Phenomenal person. Fabulous editor. And so completely devoid of ego. She's fabulous. She's a wonderful person.
All right, then we won't.
Yes, I know. No, they wouldn't do that because she'd hate it.
All right, then. Well, I've picked up a couple of comments from your blog. When you were writing The Falcon Throne, you described the process as scaring the pants off you. And I've read it, and the reading was scarily good. What about this project? Considering you've got quite a few fantasy titles under your belt, what about it scared you?
The scope. Just the sheer complexity. Everything I've written up till now, I've sort of kind of been working my way up to doing something this large. I've always wanted to play on a canvas this big, but I never trusted myself. I never thought starting off that I had the skill set that I needed to even come anywhere close to doing it well. Which is why, like the Mage books, I don't describe those as epic fantasy. They're more adventure fantasy. It's a small cast. It's an intimate cast. And the storyline is fairly linear. It's fairly self-contained. And with the Godspeaker trilogy, that was me pushing the boat out just a bit further. So that was a bit bigger, and that was me testing the waters and seeing how I was going to handle a wider cast with a more complex framework of storytelling. And that worked. And that gave me the courage to then go forward and go, okay, now I'm about ready to push the boat out again a bit further. But you know what they say, the difference between knowing a stove's hot because someone tells you a stove's hot and then sticking your hand on it? I just had no idea. It's a really big story, and as big as number one is, it's only scratching the surface in terms of complexity. And all the pre-planning for book two. I mean, I've got a wall full of family trees. I've got like so many photos and so many diagrams and so many notes trying so I can keep track of everybody and whose relationship is with whom and who's married where and what the politics are and how the personal alliances impact the national politics. And it scares it. It's just all terribly frightening because it's like juggling 400 balls and you can't drop any of them. And if whatever you start, you have to finish, and every story thread has to have a beginning and a middle and an end, and you can't leave things unfinished, and you can't start something and drop hints and not follow through on them. So it's the scope of it. It's just enormously complex. And it's, and I've got to get it right, so that scares me. It's good to be scared, though. I don't ever want to be in the place where I'm writing on automatic pilot and not invested. I think if you're not a bit scared, you're not on your toes. But bloody hell, it's an adventure.
All right. Well, my next question might have an obvious answer, but I wanted to ask it anyway. I try to be conscious of noticing the representation of women in the fiction I read. And one thing I really liked about The Falcon Throne was the variety of female characters, both good and evil, both primary and secondary. And for me, it was a really well-realised, realistic cast of characters in, in a big, well-paced epic adventure. And as a long-term reader of epic fantasy, you know, it has its tropes, its limitations, and it can be, and I've finally come to realise this recently, a very male-centred affair. And I just wondered, was there, in terms of the representation of women in your narrative, was there anything particularly wanted to achieve? Or was it just, you know, I'm writing as a woman, I'm going to put, you know, I naturally will put more women in my story?
Well, interesting you should ask that. And it's always wonderful to hear a guy talking about that they enjoy, you know, reading female characters, because not all blokes do want to read a lot of women characters. Not all blokes are comfortable being put into a female character's shoes, especially when you start, you know, getting into female point of view characters. A lot of blokes find that a little bit disconcerting, you know, for whatever reason. And what's really interesting, and this is something that I have noticed in my many, many years of observing fandom, is that while there, of course, there are many, many women who really want to read women's stories, there are also a lot of women who come into spec fic and they invest in male characters and they're less interested in female characters. It's a really, really difficult balance to maintain. And the other thing that I find interesting about your comment is that I have received criticism elsewhere that, you know, I've done a disservice to women and women characters because one of my female characters is a witch.
And
I'm thinking, okay, yeah, Azus is a witch and she does some bad things and she uses her sexuality as a weapon. But hey, you know, there's also Molly and then there's Berardine and then there's Catraine. And you know, there are other female, you know, women in the story who don't do that, who are using different skill sets to survive or thrive. So I was a little bit perplexed by that, I have to say, going, what, so is it? And then I was reading a review of some film somewhere other, and the reviewer made the point that the problem is that so often that women aren't featured that much, that when you do get a woman, they then become every woman, and so they have to be perfect in every way, otherwise you're letting the side down. And my feeling is that, well, no, you have to have everything. You have to have good women and bad women and stupid women and brave women and cowardly women. And because before we're women or men, we're people. And I think we have to be people first and show that all, you know, not every bloke is brave, not every bloke is wicked, not every bloke treats women badly. You know, so if we're people first, then that means that no matter the gender of the character, they get to have all these different facets. And if I have an agenda of my own, I guess that would be it, to say, you know, people first. So women you have to let women fail in fiction. A female character has to be allowed to fail. She has to be allowed to make mistakes. She has to be allowed to be bad. As long as that's not the only kind of woman you ever represent.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I thought one out of five women was, and all of them different, was a pretty good attempt.
I thought it was an interesting observation, and it was someone who I guess is very, very sensitive to the portrayal of women in fiction, and also because, you know, in the epic genre, fantasy, you know, epic historic fantasy genre, subgenre, it is so often male-dominated with characters, and so often the women are kept in secondary roles, and so often the only thing you ever know about them is their relationship to the men in the story, and they don't have their own, you know, agency, and they don't have their own journey. And all I can say is, well, that's not what I'm doing, and please trust me, because if you keep on reading the books as they come out, you'll see. There is. I've got a whole bunch of other female characters up my sleeve. I've got a bunch of other male characters up my sleeve, and they're all really different people. And they all have their strengths and weaknesses, and sometimes they'll do good things and sometimes they'll do bad things. But I don't ever want to get to the point where, oh, I have to have a good this and a bad that, and all of that subset has to be fabulous, because in the real world, you know, there's questions about them, so they can't ever be presented as questionable. Because that's being dishonest to human nature, I think.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Shifting focus now. I read your blog yesterday after preparing this question. I think I mentioned it either on the blog or on Facebook. But a number of Australian authors, and two that come immediately to mind is Sean Williams and Justine Labalestier, suffer from writing related injuries.
That makes three of us. Yeah.
I note in all the writing advice given, and this is pretty like a broad observation, you know, list of 10 things you must do as a writer and that sort of stuff, not much is really said about maintaining a writer's health. And I saw on your blog you've got a standing desk and you've got plans for a treadmill desk in the near future. And I wondered, what was your advice for guarding against injuries caused by writing as a career choice?
Yeah, I actually have my treadmill desk set up. I just have to get back to using it on a regular basis. But I've got my standing desk. In fact, I have two of the standing desks. I'm going to give an absolutely unsolicited and completely non-paid-for plug here. There's a company that's just launched in Australia called Varidesk, and that's who I bought my standing desk contraptions from, and they are super, super fabulous. They're not terribly expensive, and they're so brilliant because you can actually lift and lower them. So you don't have, because you should, in the same way as you shouldn't sit for hours on end, you shouldn't stand for hours on end either. You need to mix the two. But I put one in the house where my internet computer is, and so I don't ever sit in front of the internet now, unless if I'm using my laptop in the lounge room, but I don't use that very often in the lounge room. Otherwise, it's in the studio, it's in the study, and I'm standing. And then I've got another one out in my studio, out in my workspace, and I will split between standing and sitting and kneel in that, and then stand on that one as well. So Varidesk is great if you're looking for some kind of a contraption to help you get out of the sitting all the time. The only thing, when you're a part-time writer, it's a different set of circumstances. But if you're a full-time writer, or you're doing lots and lots of writing over the weekends, when you're not actually at work, and so that you grab your time and you're spending hours a day doing this. Yeah. And at my height, you know, it was not uncommon for me to be writing for 15 hours a day, sitting, which was just diabolically stupid of me. In hindsight, it's a wonderful thing. You must stay fit. You must stay physically fit. If you're going to be a writer, you must stay physically fit, because there is wear and tear. There's wear and tear on your body, as we were talking about before, because of the physiological responses to the psychological act of writing. So there's wear and tear. You must stay physically fit because, if for no other reason, that being fit means that your body is properly oxygenated, which means your brain is properly oxygenated. So you think more clearly and more efficiently than if you've, you know, got sludge in your blood and sludge in your head from just being physically unfit, you know. And I've done it both ways, and trust me, being physically fit is better. You run terrible risks when you're putting hours and hours and hours in front of a computer. And especially when you get caught up in the work, your posture can go on, you might not realize it. So you must guard your neck, and you must guard your upper lumbar spine, you must guard your lower lumbar spine. And you also must guard your wrists and your hands, because you can get, if you're not, you must take the time and educate yourself or get an expert in to help you set up your workstation so that it's ergonomically efficient and that you are not going to inadvertently damage yourself. I changed computers at one point and didn't pay enough attention to where I had the mouse in relation to the keyboard and the screen, and I gave myself tendonitis. And it took me, 3 months before I could hold a saucepan again in my right arm. Because it's all I did, and it didn't take very long of using that incorrectly for it to bugger up the tendon in my right elbow. So you must pay attention to all of those things. You have to get into the habit of, if you are going to be sitting, get an egg timer, an oven timer, and set it for 45 minutes, no more than an hour. Get up, move around, stretch, change your physicality. Because if you sit for a long time, you switch off the biomechanical impulses in your body. And that's when you can do yourself lots of damage. Make sure that you stretch regularly and that you do some strengthening exercises to keep everything toned so that your joints don't go kablooey. And if, like me, you have a history of injuries, and I have, I've had two completely major car accidents and a few smaller ones. I've had two grade 3 concussions, which is loss of consciousness, plus 4 or 5 other minor ones where I wasn't entirely unconscious, but where there was an impact. I've had, horses fall on me. I've fallen onto rocks. I've fallen onto telegraph poles. I've fallen onto I've been knocked head first into trees and into boulders. So if you're someone like me who has managed to accumulate some very interesting, injuries and wear and tear, it's even more important to keep yourself fit, because writing, hours and hours in front of a computer, will wreak havoc on your body if you are not really careful.
I was going to say, I must state for the record that those injuries weren't incurred while writing.
No. They were all incurred while I was having a wonderful life, because I had horses for many years and it was fun and I loved it, but, they're not the safest creatures on the land. And car accidents, sometimes they will happen. Probably not too many people have had as many as I have, and certainly haven't had them to the severity that I've had. But, it all chips away. And just, we get older, and if we don't maintain our physicality, it starts to deteriorate. And if the next thing your posture's gone to crap and you're slumping and your neck juts forward and your chin juts forward and your spine slumps, and you're in all kinds of trouble. You should try and get yourself into a kneel sit kind of chair, because that puts you in better spinal alignment. Failing that, one of those good heavy duty larger exercise balls you can sit on those, because they force you to maintain a good posture and they also keep your muscles firing, because there's constant little adjustments to keep yourself on them, and that can be going on while you're working. Your brain's engaged in the work, but your body is making minute muscle adjustments all the way through, and that keeps your body alive and stops all your neurological connections going to sleep and helps to prevent the wear and tear that prolonged sitting can inflict upon you.
Okay, maybe there's an e-book that needs to be released on health for writers.
Yes. Physical survival for writers. I think we underestimate. I mean, it just took a very long time for it to dawn on me. I'd be putting in hard days of work and I'd be writing certain scenes and I'd get up, to grab something to eat or run to the loo or whatever, and I'd go, oh my God, I hurt. I'm aching. My muscles are aching and I'm tense. And it took me a long time for the pen to drop to recognize, that's because, in your mind you're fighting this enormous battle.
Mm.
And your body thinks you're actually doing it. And the other thing, if you can swing it, if you can manage it, and for me it's become basically a survival process, every couple of weeks get yourself a really good deep tissue massage. because that helps to iron all the kinks. It will hurt a lot, but it will do you good.
No, I've had one of those before, and I likened it to torture.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was good torture.
My spinal issues are such that because I've also had, like, one ruptured disc, four prolapse discs, and so I just, as a matter of survival and maintenance, I have to have a deep tissue massage usually every week. So I get tortured every week, but it's what keeps me going.
All right, then. Well, this is my last question. You've been a bookseller, and you've seen the big companies crush the independents, leaving a few bricks and mortar stores holding on to compete against Amazon and whatever happens to pop up next, if anything does. Using your crystal ball, what do you think the future holds for the book industry, and what would you like to see as an author?
Well, I honestly don't know. We're in such a weird space at the moment. The only thing I know for certain is that stories will survive. That's because human beings as a species are hardwired for story. And we've been telling each other stories, you know, since the Neanderthals sat around, a fire in a cave and talked about whatever they talked about. So human beings are hardwired for story. It will never leave. The delivery mechanisms might change, and certainly we're seeing shifts in the paradigm of, you know, delivery mechanisms now. I hope that ideally, you know, because when it becomes cyclical and it becomes this rise and fall of, you know, the big bricks and mortars came in and they killed a lot of the independents, and then half of one of those major chains fell over for various different reasons. What you would like to see is the smaller independents, you know, popping up again. The difficulty is that other things have changed now. The sheer overhead cost of maintaining a bricks and mortar store and paying staff and you know, all the costs of physically maintaining a business, I think that makes it difficult, especially when there's a lot of economies that are traditionally the book buying economies, the cultures and the societies that love to read books and support books are struggling. You know, people are struggling to feed families, and the first thing that happens is that, you know, expensive discretionary items like books, they get left behind because people have, you know, they're not going to buy a book if they have to put food in their kids' mouths. So when the economy is struggling, as it is in various places, allied with pressures on booksellers, it does make things a little bit tough. And when you have companies that don't mind playing hardball to better their bottom line at the expense of other people, that can get tricky as well. But having said that, like the last week I went around to a few of the Sydney bookshops to sign some in-store stock, and all of them were really busy with people, and that was exciting. Because as much as the convenience of online bookselling is brilliant, and I avail myself of it, there is nothing like a physical presence where you walk in and you say to a bookseller, what's new, what's great, what have you read recently, what's a great story you can recommend to me that I might not have read yet? And that is not, it's a kind of interaction that you don't get even when, you know, the online booksellers will go, oh, if you like this, you might like blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you read a whole bunch of reviews, but reviews can be suspect, and there's just nothing takes the place of a face-to-face, you know, exciting conversation with a bookseller. It was certainly my favourite aspect of the business when I had my shop, was, you know, having people come into the shop going, what's new? And I could, because I used to read just about all of the new releases that came in. So I was able to say, oh, this one's great and I love this one. And if you like X, you'll probably like this writer. Because that was the big buzz for me, was getting people excited and turned on to books that I thought were fabulous or books that I thought they would love. So I'm hoping we maintain that to some extent. I'm hoping that online doesn't kill off entirely the human face of bookselling, because it is a profoundly important human connection going on of people telling each other, being excited about books and excited about stories. So I just don't know. I think we're in such a bizarro state of flux with so many elements of the business at the moment that it's almost impossible to know how it's going to settle down. But I do have faith. I do have faith that at the end of the day, the stories will win.
Yeah, well, on that positive note, I'd like to thank you very much for agreeing to the interview and being so entertaining today.
Thank you for listening to me
today.
Gas bag on.
Oh, that was lovely. I could listen for longer. So, yes, thank you very much.